بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين، والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وعلى آله وصحبه أجمعين. أما بعد، welcome to our second presentation on the history of 1914 and beyond, the making of the modern Muslim world. And today I am honored to have our dear colleague. He's well known to all of us, mashallah, tabarakallah, one of the very active members of our community, Dr. Nabil Bayakli, and he will be joining us, and inshallah the bulk of the presentation will be his. I wanted to just start off by two things. Number one, the status of Jerusalem, of Palestine, in our tradition, and number two, a very brief history for those of you who didn't attend on Wednesday. How many of you did not attend on Wednesday? So we have just a few who were not able to attend on Wednesday, so just 2 or 3 minutes on that. Now, Jerusalem, as we all know, Baytul Maqdis, and in fact the broader land of Sham, in Arabic, Sham. And when the Quran and the Sunnah references Sham, the reference is not to modern Syria only. Modern Syria is one section of the classical Sham. When the Prophet ﷺ mentioned Sham, Sham includes Jerusalem, Baytul Maqdis, what we now call Jordan, Palestine, the entire region of the Levant. This is called Sham in the classical tradition. And this region, which includes obviously Baytul Maqdis, and in fact it is the pinnacle of Sham, this region has been praised in the Quran and in the Sunnah. And Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala mentions regarding Baytul Maqdis in particular and Sham in general, سُبْحَانَ الَّذِي أَسْرَى بِعَبْدِهِ لَيْلًا مِّنَ الْمَسْجِدِ الْحَرَامِ إِلَى الْمَسْجِدِ الْأَقْصَى. All praises due to Allah, exalted be Allah, who took His servant from the Masjid al-Haram to the Masjid al-Aqsa, الَّذِي بَارَكْنَا حَوْلَهُ, whose surroundings we have blessed. So Allah references, if the surroundings of Aqsa are blessed, how about Aqsa itself? Think about this. If the surroundings of Aqsa, Allah says, I have blessed that, how do you think Masjid al-Aqsa itself? And it is mentioned in the ahadith that Masjid al-Aqsa was the second place of worship ever established on earth. The Prophet ﷺ said that between the building of the Kaaba and the building of Masjid al-Aqsa is 40 years. And therefore we believe that the second masjid on earth, the first masjid, we believe Ibrahim built it, and that is the Kaaba. The second masjid was Masjid al-Aqsa, and that masjid became the focal point of one of Allah's chosen people, and that is the Israelites, the Bani Israel. For millennia, for many centuries, the Bani Israel considered Baytul Maqdis to be the primary Qibla, and Allah not just allowed this, Allah told them this was their primary Qibla. For them, the Baytul Maqdis was indeed their primary Qibla. And our Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, in that famous hadith in Sahih Muslim, he said, Allahumma barik lana fi madinatina, وَبَارِكْ لَنَا فِي شَامِنَا. O Allah, bless us in our Medina and bless us in our Sham. And he repeated this 3 times. And it is amazing that when he said this hadith, Sham didn't belong to the Muslims. Yet he ascribed it to us. O Allah, bless us in our Medina. Okay, Medina is ours. Medina is the Prophet's, it's ours. وَفِي شَامِنَا. And when he said this, Sham is Roman territory. When he said this, Sham is under Roman dominion, yet he ascribed Sham to us. It is as if we are the rightful owners of this land. And it is our Sham. It is our Syria and Palestine and Baytul Maqdis and Jerusalem. All of this is ours. And he ascribed it to himself. And that is why he was always eager to take the first armies out of Arabia into Sham. In fact, even before the da'wah of Islam began, we learned from, we did this in our seerah class, that when the Prophet ﷺ was born, the people saw, and his mother in particular, saw a light coming from Sham. This is at his birth, that Sham is sending the light to Mecca, right? It is as if the light is emanating, waiting for the Prophet ﷺ to come to it. So even from his birth, Sham is sending out a light. It's a signal that this is the land of the Prophet ﷺ. And that is why our Prophet ﷺ, the only region that he was interested in outside of Arabia in his lifetime was Sham. And we talked about this in our seerah, the Battle of Mu'tah, the Battle of Tabuk. All of this is intended to get up there. And that is why in the very last week of his life, he sent once again Usama ibn Zayd, as we will study inshallah in our seerah, once again he sent him up north. Once again the goal is to get to Syria. And that is why when he passed away sallallahu alayhi wasallam, the one army that was leaving Medina was the army intended to get Baytul Maqdis. And that is why Abu Bakr said, I can't stop it. I can't get between the Prophet and Baytul Maqdis. And that is why the first land that was conquered in the reign of Abu Bakr as-Siddiq was indeed Baytul Maqdis. And as we know that Abu Bakr died and Umar became the Khalifa, and the people of Jerusalem, the siege was going on, the people of Jerusalem said, we will only hand over the city if the Khalifa himself comes. So one of the first acts, we can say the first act of Umar ibn al-Khattab, was to travel to Jerusalem to take over the city of Jerusalem. And the city of Jerusalem, very, very briefly, and by the way, technically, we don't call it Haram. It is not, some people say, Thalithul Haramain. No, there's two Harams in Islam, Mecca and Medina. Jerusalem is Ard Muqaddas. It's not Haram. Haram is a fiqh term. Haram is a term that means there is certain things that are Haram in it that are Halal outside of it. Jerusalem is not Haram. It is Holy Land. And in Islam, holy land is different than haram. Mecca and Medina and Jerusalem are three holy lands. And our Prophet ﷺ said that nobody should undertake a religious journey except to Mecca, Medina, and Jerusalem. And very briefly, the city of Jerusalem is one of the oldest inhabited areas in this world. We know from archaeological evidence that people have been living there for over 5,500 years. One of the earliest civilizations ever in the history of humanity, one of the earliest continuously inhabited regions of earth is this land of Jerusalem. And both Muslims, Christians, and Jews, we all venerate this land, and we all believe that Dawood alayhi salam, of course we believe that Ya'qub and his progeny lived in the vicinity, and then they went to Egypt as we know, and then Dawood alayhi salam, he was the one who conquered it in 970 BC. 970 BC, Dawood conquered it, and his son Sulaiman built one of the most magnificent structures ever seen in the history of humanity. We believe because Allah allowed the jinn to help him. So the jinn basically did something that man had never seen. And so the Temple of Solomon was a wonder of the world, one of the magnificent wonders that the world had never seen. And how could it have seen it when its architects are the jinn? So the Temple of Sulaiman, we believe, and the Jews believe, and the Christians believe, it is one of the most magnificent structures ever built in the history of humanity. And it was the pinnacle of the Israelites when they had the Temple of Solomon. But Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala willed that they would only last in this glory when they were faithful to Him. So when the Bani Israel were not faithful to their Lord, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala allowed other people to overtake Jerusalem. And again, very briefly, in 722 BCE, for the first time, Jerusalem was taken away from the Bani Israel by the Assyrians and then the Babylonians. And then the Babylonians would expel the Jews. This is called the Babylonian expulsion. That was the first time the Jews had to spread the diaspora. They were spread all over the world. Eventually, the Persians conquered it, and one of their kings, King Cyrus, in around 516 BCE, so we're still talking about 3,000 years ago, 2,700 years ago, King Cyrus allowed them to rebuild the temple, and this is called the Second Temple. Now, this was built by them, not by the jinn. Nonetheless, it was a magnificent structure. It was the Second Temple, and eventually, the Romans conquered it from the Persians, and during the time of Jesus Christ, Isa, as we all know, the Romans were the ones in charge of Jerusalem. Shortly after Isa's ascent, 70 CE, so now we're changing from BC to CE, 70 CE, the Jews revolted against the Romans. This is called the famous Jewish Revolt, and the Romans backlashed, and they almost massacred, they expelled the Jews again, and they destroyed the temple, and they crushed the Jewish revolt, and they put some very harsh penalties on public Jewish worship and Jewish living in the city. And up until the coming of the Muslims, Jews had a hard time in Jerusalem for 500 years. To be publicly Jewish and to have a synagogue and to practice Judaism, there were measures, there were strict measures placed upon them. And it was only with the coming of Islam that the Jews could finally worship freely in their holy city. And the Christians, to show their attitude towards the Jews, had converted the land that was the Holy Temple, they had converted it into a dump, into a trash can, into a public, a pit of, filth and najis and all that. They had done this to show the Yahud what they think of them. When Umar ibn al-Khattab conquered the city in 634 CE, this is a date we should all memorize, 634 of the Christian era, he was the one, the Muslims cleansed The Muslims purified the land. And nearby in the vicinity, not on it, contrary to popular opinion, nearby they built what we now call basically the Dome of the Rock, right? In the same rough vicinity, they built the Dome of the Rock. And the Dome of the Rock, the Umayyads built it, and it is one of the magnificent architectural structures that has remained in the Ummah for the last 14 centuries. It's one of the earliest masjids built in Islam, and it is still, the actual structure is the same structure, the dome, and the inscriptions date from the time of the Umayyads. It remained in Muslim lands, from Muslim hands, from 634 CE up until 1099 CE. This is a date that, again, we need to memorize. 1099. What happened in 1099? The Crusades. Out of nowhere, a bunch of Frenchmen and Germans and Englishmen, unprovoked, without any reason, they launched a series of campaigns beginning in Europe and working all the way to Jerusalem, and they conquered Jerusalem from Muslim hands, and a very evil, infamous massacre ensued of every single man, woman, child in the city. Every single Muslim in the city was slaughtered by the sword. Not by some chemical weapon, not by a bomb, by the sword. That's one by one, you kill them. And it is estimated that at least 500,000, maybe even more than this, died by the sword, until the cities of Jerusalem, until the streets of Jerusalem, by the testimony of the Franks themselves, were knee-deep or ankle-deep in blood. Muslim blood. The whole city is now basically flooded with Muslim blood. And the Frank general is a very famous letter he wrote, the pleasing the Pope, that you will be pleased to know that, you know, we have slaughtered so many of these heathens that the city is now flowing in blood. So Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala tested us in this regard, that we were not faithful to our religion, so Jerusalem was taken away from us. And it took us 87, 88 years. It took us two generations. 88 years is not a small period of time. Two full generations. When Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blessed that Kurdish general, the Salah ad-Din al-Ayyubi, to come forth and reconquer it back and give it back to its rightful owners. And that took place in 1187. So 1099 to 1187. These are the two dates that need to be borne in mind. 1099, the Crusaders took it. 1187, Salah ad-Din reconquered it. And after that time, it has remained in Muslim lands for up until recent history. The Ayyubids, and then the Mamluks, and then the Ottomans, all of them are taking care of Baytul Maqdis. Jews, Christians, Muslims are all allowed to worship. For the first time, you have churches and synagogues and masjids side by side, and there is complete freedom of every religion to worship as it pleases. This didn't exist in the times of the Romans. It didn't exist in the time of the Crusades. Only under Islam, you had all of the religions flourishing, and this was to change in 1917, as we said in our Wednesday class, when General Allenby entered Jerusalem after 800 years of Muslim rule. General Allenby entered Jerusalem and reconquered it for the British, and more than 96 years, 95 years have gone this time around. Last time it was 88 years. This time, you do the math. 1917, and now we are in 2014, has just begun, right? 97 years basically has gone by this time, and it has been away from our hands. Allah knows who will be the next Salah ad-Din. Allah knows what's going to happen, but we firmly believe that that land is our land. That, as our Prophet ﷺ said, "Barik lana fi shamina." That is our territory. It is Allah's right and privilege to us that He has given us. And Allah Azza wa Jalla knows what the future will be. Very quickly, for those who did not attend on Wednesday, there's only two or three things that we can say in this short period of time. And that is that the British double-crossed the Muslims multiple times by promising the same land to different people. They promised it to the Arabs. They promised it to the Arabs if they revolted against the Muslims. Against the Ottomans. Yes, against the Muslims. One group of Muslims, if they fought against another group of Muslims, the British said, "We'll give you Baytul Maqdis, we'll give you a free Jerusalem, a united Arab caliphate." And this was promised to the Sharif of Mecca, who was the most prestigious Muslim ruler at the time, and the only ruler who could really have a claim against the Ottomans. So the British bribed him and promised him that if you fight against the Ottomans, you will be given a united Arabia spanning from east and west and north and south. The entire caliphate will be handed over to you. And he was paid money and he was given false promises. And while this is going on, the British have already decided that they want this land for themselves. And this is the Sykes-Picot Agreement, that top secret meetings between the British and the French and the Russians and the Brits say, we're going to keep this land for ourselves. And they promise what is now Lebanon and other lands to France, and they promise Constantinople, Istanbul to the Russians. And they said, we will keep Urdun and what they called the Transjordan at the time. Transjordan is what we now call Palestine and Israel and Jordan and Syria. This is basically Transjordan. The Brits said, we're going to keep that. As they're making this, they then promise it to the Zionists as well. And this is called the Balfour Declaration. And the Zionists were given this. We said there are many reasons. Perhaps the most obvious reason was that one of the leaders of the Zionist movement was a very, very influential businessman who's producing stuff that is needed for their bombs. That's acetone. Okay. They needed
He was a chemist.
He also owns the company that's producing acetone. And it is said that when the issue of negotiations and payments came, he said, I don't want your money. I want Palestine. This is what I want if you want my acetone. I don't need your money. I want Palestine. And so they promised him with the Balfour Declaration, and that's where we ended in 1918 and 1919. We ended over there, and I'm going to now hand it over to Dr. Nabil to take it from there to the present. Jazakumullah khair, and Dr. Nabil, the floor is all yours.
Inshallah, that was a very, very brief and concise history about Jerusalem itself, and actually we can even go by just talking about Jerusalem and the history of Jerusalem, which will be good for all of us actually to understand when was Jerusalem built, who built it, and through history, how many names Jerusalem actually changed names as well through the history. And I will start here, and I will need the first slide, please, with the, okay. And this is what Sheikh Yasser was talking about as far as Bilad al-Sham. So this is really the end of the Turkish Empire. And you see this how the Ottoman Empire had divided Bilad al-Sham into different vilayat or wilayat. And also sanajiq, we say in Arabic, or sanjiq for individual. And as you notice that it was really divided between the wilaya of Halab or Aleppo, Hama, and including within the wilaya of Hama was actually the Ladqiya and the place where the Alawites are and all of this. And then this is the wilaya or the wilaya of Beirut from all the way between Palestine, Lebanon, or what used to be the Mount of Lebanon and Ladqiya and all of this. So this is really, really the end of the Ottoman Empire, and then the next slide, can I use that? Okay. This is really the next slide, and this is what Sykes-Picot was about, and this is what Sheikh Yasser was talking. And if you go between the two, it's almost the same. The only difference here is that, and this is really a good reminder for us who are going through, for our brothers in Syria, is that to see that really the one who put the seed of division between the Muslims to have a state by themselves, between the Alawis, the Shia, and the Druze, and all this, were really nothing but Sykes-Picot. So here you see that state of Aleppo, and this is really the wilaya or the Iskandaron, which is really, it used to belong to Wilayat al-Sham or the Bilad al-Sham, and now they added to Turkey. And right here will be the mandatory of Palestine, what is Transjordan, what really Transjordan was about. And this is, again, the beginning of 1920. This is how the Middle East looked like, with the Transjordan being the future place where Palestine is going to be placed. Now, we have to go then from this Transjordan here, right, which is really a very, very large state and a very large area. And what the Zionist organization was looking for is really what used to be, or what they call it, the Kingdom of Judea. So on the left side, you see the Kingdom of Judea. And this is what was established in the year 700 before Common Era, what Sheikh Yasser was talking about, to the present day, which is at that time was really 1920. So this is really what they wanted. The World Zionist Organization presented this, that this is what really they want in Palestine. And I know Sheikh Yasser was very quick. There was one thing should be mentioned, is that the World Zionist Organization came first to Sultan Abdul Hamid in the late 1800s, and they really wanted to buy the land of Palestine. They wanted to buy the land of Palestine. And Sultan Abdul Hamid at that time said that Palestine is a, I don't know if I remember that, waqf. It is a waqf because Jerusalem is a waqf. It's a waqf. It's not really for the Ottomans to buy and sell or the Uthmaniyin to buy and sell. It belongs to all Muslims. No one person can buy it and sell it. So they knew that if the Muslims understand this point is that Palestine and Jerusalem is a waqf or Quds is a waqf, then by this way they cannot really, no one can, they cannot buy it as a real estate. So from there on, they knew that things have to be divided, the map has to change, so on, in order for them really to be able to acquire and take in Palestine as now we know it. So the very first thing, right after 1919, and they were actually, from there on, there was the first Aliyah and the second Aliyah. I don't know if Sheikh Yasser talked about them, because the if you go by the census, and you're going to see how many censuses were taken, that really the Palestine, as we know it, used to have Jews. Jews always lived there. Nobody denies this. And I should really make this from now, is that whenever I say Jewish or I say Zionist and all this, I'm really talking about those people who really came from Europe and moved to the Palestine. As far as Muslims should be are concerned, and as Sheikh Yasser said, and as you see it actually in the Sunnah of the Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam, the neighbor, the next door neighbor of the Prophet was a Jew. And when Muslims came into Palestine or into into Quds, it is the time in which the Jews regained their dignity and their honor and were allowed to worship freely. In fact, before even Umar signed the treaty, the issue that Umar radiallahu anhu had to argue with the Romans was what? The status of the Jews inside Palestine. The status of the Jews inside Jerusalem was negotiated by Umar radiallahu anhu. And the Romans would not really surrender the keys of Jerusalem to Umar without Umar agreeing that he shouldn't allow the Jews to be in Palestine. So I'm just saying this now because in case somebody want to say that the Muslims are really against Jews, no. As Muslims, we have no issue, no bone to pick, as they say, with Jews and the Jews practicing their faith. In fact, again, it should be always noted that the only time that Jerusalem was freely, everybody freely worshipped is between Christians, Jews, and Muslims is when the Muslims were in control. And look through the history. Look through the history. That's the only time when all these three religions practiced freely. When the Christians took over Jerusalem, then the Christians actually didn't allow not only the Muslims and the Jews, but even the Christians, those who have what's called Eastern pulpits, which means the Orthodox Christians, the Coptic Christians, all these Christians who were not European-based, were not really allowed to practice their faith as well, besides the Muslims and the Jews as well. And now we know that Jerusalem is in the hands of the Jews or the Israelis, and as we see now, regardless of what the Zionist Christians tell you here in the United States, the Arab Christians and the Orthodox Christians and the Coptic Christians, and the way they are being treated inside under the occupation is also in a very inhumane way. So again, the point is that if we say Jews or we mention Zionism or Zionism, it's only to make people understand is that this is the politics, this is the political Zionism, and really we should differentiate a lot of time or take a note or say what's political Zionism as well. So again, in the late 1920, the Haganah was established, or the Hajjanah. The Hajjanah were nothing but really a military group that were underground, and they were established specifically to defend the interest of Jews in Palestine. So this is 1920, and if you look at the 1920 and you take the census, really the Jews were less than 3% at that time with the total land, the total what we consider Palestine or historic Palestine. And in April 1920, there was a riot against the mass migration from Jews, Jews from Europe into Haifa, into Yaffa. And this is also, they call it the riots of Yaffa and so on. And because of these riots, then the British sponsored a commission of inquiry and attribute the riots to. So this is, the British are the one who's saying, what is the cause of the riot? Why the Arabs and the Muslims in Yaffa really rioted against the concentration or the Jews in that area. First of all, disappointments among the Palestinians. What is disappointment? I think one thing also should be noted is that there was a United Nations resolution, UN Resolution 22. And that UN Resolution 22 saying that by the end of World War I, every country or every province should have its own independence. And among these provinces that should have had its independence was the province of Palestine. So by that time, it was already over, and they were waiting, in a way, the Palestinians, for the United Nations to give them the right to have their own independence and to have their own country. But instead of having their own independence, they had the British mandate. Instead of having and allowing the Palestinians to establish their own country, then the United Nations went through another caveat, and they established what's called the Mandate of Palestine. So the Palestinians, from there on, they start seeing this is disappointing. What's this democracy you were telling us about? And we're going to keep talking about this issue. Besides that, this is about the mass migration of European Jews. And you will see in numbers, this is the World Zionist Organization, and the World Zionist Organization has made on itself the promise that they're going to keep bringing Jews from all over the world, and basically from all over Europe at that time, into Palestine. So this was mass migrations. We're talking about tens of thousands of Jews coming from all over Europe into Palestine. And by coming into Palestine, they were coming as also rich people, right? They were really sending the money. So they were owning and buying and controlling the economics of this country. They also knew about the lobbying power of the Jews in London. I mean, what Sheikh Yasser was talking about, Chaim Weizmann, one of the issues that Chaim Weizmann, one of the things he used to do is that he used to rent a room right by the British House of Commons. And he used to watch the lords when they're coming to the meetings to see every one of them what time that person is going to come. And he knew that which person he needs to talk to. And as the person is coming, he would come out of his room and walk with that guy and start talking to him about the issues of the Jews. So this is where the lobbying power started. This is where the lobbying power. I know now we got a lot of lobbies in D.C. with all due respect to them. But all of this really started with Weizmann. And he knew about the lobbying power that he had. First of all, he was rich. He was a chemist, and he was working on the pathway for acetone, a chemical pathway, which was needed for the British and the Allies so that they will convert the nitrogens into explosive powers. At that time, most of the nitrates and the nitrogen used to come from Germany, and they are at war with Germany, so they couldn't get the explosives. They couldn't get to make the explosives, so they needed this pathway in order for them to make the bombs that they needed for the war. And Dr. Weizmann, he wouldn't really turn in his pathway, right? This guy is working in a lab. He wouldn't turn his notebook, right, without the Balfour promise that he really wanted. He didn't want any money, as Sheikh Yasser said. He was very rich. And you can see, actually, there's a lot to talk about. But alhamdulillah, I try to move as fast as I can. So this is, again, the what Transjordan used to be. This is Transjordan from taking Jordan and Palestine. And for the Arabs, I know I grew up in an environment that talks saying that حُدُودُكِ يَا فُلَسْطِينَ يَا إِسْرَائِيلَ مِنَ الْفُرَاتِ إِلَى النِّيلَ. I don't know if anybody heard this, meaning that the boundaries of Israel is from the Furat, Euphrates, to the Nile. And you tell every Jew here in the United States, or every, I say, no, this is not true. This is not what I really want. And alhamdulillah, I got to a map where it says, it is in Hebrew, and it says, Erads, and this here is what? Israel, right? Erads means Ard, Arabic. Ard, just take that, that's what the Ard Israel. And you see actually the map, this is all the way where Iraq is here, and this is here is Egypt. So yes, at some time, and this is was given by the Stern gang, by the Ergun gang, and we'll talk about the Ergun and the establishment of the Ergun. The Ergun were just an offshoot of the Hajjana, which were established in 1919 or 1920. And later on, then, some of the Hajjana came off because they thought that the Hajjana was not doing they were not massacring the Palestinians enough. So we need to be a little bit more aggressive against the Palestinians. And this is really 1930 we're talking about. So again, this is a map that is issued by the Irgun. And you see that, actually, what do they want? The whole land. They wanted the whole land. So right now, whoever talks about Israel, right now, anyone, Netanyahu himself, or whatever, Barack Obama, or whoever he is, and they talk about Israel, what you talk about Israel is one thing, what they talk about Israel is something else. And even Ismail Haniyeh and Sheikh Ahmed Yassin and all of them, when they were saying, are you going to recognize the state of Israel, all what they say is what? By Allah, all what they say is what? Let them recognize their state, draw the map, and we will get their people inside the map of all of them inside them, and we're ready to recognize them. When you tell me recognize Israel, which Israel you want me to recognize? Which Israel? The only country that up till now doesn't recognize its own geographical political border is Israel. So when you say, do you recognize Israel? The answer is, which Israel do you want me to recognize? Right? So this is one map of Israel, and it tells you, it shows you that actually what they have in their mind, what they consider as Ard Israel, the land of Israel, is all the way from Iraq to Egypt. And this is what they call as the Promised Land or the Holy Land. So again, I know that Lord Balfour did issue his famous declaration, but everybody who dealt with the Zionists at that time were not bought to the Zionist dream. And to Zionist ambassador, and one of them was Lord Karzun. Lord Karzun, and it says clearly here that while Weizmann tells you one thing, and you are thinking in terms of a national Jewish homeland, he has something quite different in mind. You see? So they knew that ambition. They knew what ambition, what they tell you, and what is it that they're working on. So this is not really new. Don't blame Mahmoud Abbas now. All right? Don't blame the leadership of the Palestinians now. Whoever dealt with the Zionist organization know that they're ready to tell you one thing, and they're actually working on something else behind the scenes. And this is actually Lord Karzun. This is right after Balfour. This is around 1920 and so on. He already mentioned that. He already told you that. You know, they will feed you one thing and they work on another thing. They take things bits and pieces, piece by piece. And this is, again, tell Kerry, this is what's going on right now. Right now, still they go on with the same process, the same plan from the word, from the time they established the Zionist organization until now. It's still going on with the same plan. He has something quite different in mind. He envisaged a Jewish state and a subject Arab population. And a subject Arab population, which means second-class citizens, right? If you still remember with the Balfour Declaration, it says on a condition, right? The states, Balfour Declaration, His Majesty the President or the Governor of Britain looks in eyes of favor for the establishment of a national Jewish homeland for the Jews in the land of Palestine on the condition. Even Balfour put that condition, saying that that establishment is not going to jeopardize the right of the national inhabitants of the land. So knowing that you cannot make this country or this state without treating the people who are living there as second-class citizens, this is what Lord Karzun is talking about. This is what, that he already seen that they are already trying to treat the Arabs as second-class citizens, even at the time in 1920. So since he was a lord and he's in the House of Lords, then what did they do to him? They shipped him to India. Okay, so they said, you're no longer dealing with, and actually he's the one in charge of really dividing India the way it is now. He was one of the people who figured that, who did that. So again, you will see the tactics that the Zionist organization, World Zionist Organization, would do. So this is the first thing, we got a hurdle here, we got to deal with this hurdle. So what do you do? Okay, we're not going to keep you now in the Middle East. You have no more, what you call a haqiba or any kind of role for you in the Middle East, so we ship him to India and let him deal with the condition of the situation in India. So this is what happened to him. So in 1922, the British Census of Palestine says 78% Muslims, 11 Jewish, 9.6 Christians, 1.4 Druze, So even this is the British. This is the British census. What do you think? What's wrong with these numbers? This is still their census. This is the census that's done by the British government or the British mandate. You cannot reach everybody when you're doing census. In general, when you do census, you only reach actually the places where it's inhabitants. And the Palestinians, a lot of them at that time were also farmers, so these were not be able. So by looking at this, even that they divided among Muslims, Christians, and Druze, but Muslim, Christians, and Druze are what? They are the Arabs, right? So instead of saying that really Palestine, by their definition, is 89% Arabs and 11% Jews, then that number is what? That makes it the white supermajority, right? So by doing this, then, well, the Jews are the second most populous. You see that? You got an argument now, right? By doing this, then the Jews are the second most populous in Palestine. So this is 19, again, from there on, there was always scrimmages, back and forth. The Haganah was there. Again, the Haganah, I know they say that their interest was what? Military organization under government, under world military organization. Its object is what? To defend Jewish national and Jewish interest in the land of Palestine. So they were always there, and they were always really doing the scrimmages. And again, really, for the sake of brevity, for the sake of brevity, is that we go by, you know, we leap. This is a big leap in the history of Palestine when you go from 1922 to 1928. In an attempt to claim the Wailing Wall is the Western Wall. It's now what's known as the Western Wall, which is where Masjid al-Aqsa is. Not Dome of the Rock, not Masjid al-Sakhra. You see, in Arabic we say Masjid al-Aqsa and Masjid al-Sakhra, the Dome of the Rock. The Dome of the Rock is the one that's built by the Umayyad. And Masjid al-Aqsa is the one that was built by Sulaiman alayhi salatu wasalam. So these are two different mosques. However, they are in the same sanctuary. They are in the same compound, right? So the Wailing Wall is what the Jews consider as the Western Wall. And for them, it is really the most the most religious or the most sacred place. And they claim that this is really the Wailing Wall. And we're not here in debating this issue. We will go by most historian or what the people now say. So they started bringing, and for anyone who knows how what the Jews would do in Palestine, like whenever they want to start a settlement, what do? They take an RV, or they take a van or a bus, or they take a tent, and they put it in a certain area, and they start praying there. Once they do this, then that area becomes what? Sanctified. A kotel. They call it kotel. This is a kotel. So this is a place of worship, so you cannot leave that area. So the Israeli government and the Israeli forces, when they want to come and say, what? You're working against the Torah. This is how these settlements were established. This is how these settlements were established, by nothing but one family or two families going into a certain area in the West Bank and making a tent and started praying here. From there on, that's it. Nobody can really remove them, because this is now a sanctified land, and the Jews cannot evict a Jew from a holy land that person has. This is how they do. So the Arabs, the Palestinians, we know this tactic, right? So what do the Jews do? They bring chairs, right? And they bring a bench, and they bring some tents or some cloth, so that they will separate the males from the females in their prayers, because I don't know if you know about it, there are certain areas and there are certain places actually women are not allowed to be. They cannot read from the Torah, they cannot touch, and so on and so on. They're very, very strict on this issue. Now, the British, they knew that if you allow them, that it's going to become permanent, so they kept removing them. The Jews will come, put them back. They remove them, the Jews come back. So what did the Palestinians do? They put them a road. They started a road between where they put the benches and the Wailing Wall. So this way, if there is a road, then they cannot really use it. So this is when the Jews revolted. This is when the Jews revolted. The outcome of all of this is 133 Jews were killed and 116 Arabs were killed. Again, they use this as a great massacre against the Jews, is that, look, they don't allow us to worship, they don't allow us. And that's not really the issue, as Sheikh Yasser said, and we keep saying, is that they've been living there all their lives. But this is a tactic that the Zionists would use. And again, by living with them, knowing what they do, then you try to prevent that in that manner. So then what happened? The British did another inquiry after the riots in Yaffa, now the riots in Jerusalem. In 1930, the British colonial secretary, Lord Passfield, issued the Passfield White Papers. And I know Sheikh Yasser talked about it. You can see how many white papers they have. The report bluntly put the blame on the Jews and primarily the Jewish agency. Is that they are the one who really instigating all of these things. They really want to Judaize the whole area, the whole region. So they are putting all their wretched people, in a sense, to start causing trouble. So this way, they will use the Hajjana and terrorize other people. By terrorizing other people, people are going to run away because the British are not going to do anything. They're really spineless. The British at that time, in a way, they were spineless against what the World Zionist Organization and the Hajjana were doing. The report concluded the Arabs have come to see the Jewish immigration not only a menace to their livelihood, but also a possible overlord for the future. So again, this was 1930, right? We started in 1920 with the riots of Yaffa, and now in 1930 with the riots of Jerusalem. So all the time, it wasn't really ambiguous for the Palestinians. It wasn't really ambiguous for them. It was known that they were coming here. They're not coming here for peace. They're not coming here for religious reasons because they've been already here. And who are these? Most of them, we're saying, where are they coming from? Europe. European Jews. I always say that the European Christians came to United States, came to America, and what did they do? They kicked the natives out, right? They kicked the natives, they put them in concentration camp, and then they built the United States of America. The European Jews came where? To Palestine, and they kicked the Palestinian out, they built their own settlements, and there. So it's, in fact, the IPAC, every time the IPAC, they have their annual convention, they remind the United States, say, we have common history, we were both built on the same way, in the same manner. Nobody knows what they're talking about in that moment when they say that. They think they're talking about Judeo-Christian. That's not what they're talking about. They're talking about Europeans who came from Europe to this land, kicked the natives out of it, and Europeans who came to Palestine and kicked the people out of it. And this is how they were established. So they really did. Then the Irgun gang was officially established. And the Irgun, again, it is an offshoot of the Hajjana. The only difference is that these guys are more militant. The Hajjana, where they found them, that they were diplomatic. It's not good enough, the riots of Haifa, of Yaffa. I keep saying Haifa and Yaffa because in Arabic, you know, we have them, أخذوا حيفا محكيناش, أخذوا يافا, قلنا بلاش, أخذوا تل أبيب, you know. So we have really a proverb saying that. So again, the Irgun gang is an offshoot of the Hajjana. Their policy was based on what's called revisionist Zionism of Ze'ev or Ze'ev. Okay, Ze'ev is Ze'ev. Ze'ev means wolf. All the wolf camera that you have is really, the original name is Ze'ev. This is one thing about the Zionists, is that they assume one name, you know, within their Zionist organization, and they have other pseudonym or whatever name that they will give the others. So this is Jabotinsky. Jabotinsky, revisionist. This is just in a peaceful manner. It's not really a revisionist. He's a terrorist, whatever you want to say, bloodthirsty person. Is that this Hajjana is not doing enough to terrorize the Palestinians. We need to do a real job in kicking them out of this country. So what they're going to do? He believed only Jewish militancy will lead to the establishment of a Jewish state. And this is really what comes. If you now Google the Irgun in the Jewish library, and you will get this publication here. This is what they say. The Irgun put out professional publications on combat doctrine, weaponry, leadership, drill exercises, all of these things. just to get short, the Argonne also started workshops that manufacture spare parts and attachments for the weapons. And I put this here under with the red color. Why? Because we should, you should know that the airplane that leaves United States, the F-16 that leaves United States and gets to Israel is no longer the same one. It's no longer the same one. They're going to modify it so that the United States military will not know what the Israeli weapons are. That's their bread and butter. If they get any spy plane or whatever plane, once it gets to Israel, right, because there's really a defense treaty, they modify it so that the United States wouldn't know what Israel really has. And not only that, they really advance it. So you got to give it to them. You really have to give it to them, is that whatever they acquire, whatever they take, they're going to modify. It's not going to be the same. It's not going to be the same. In fact, there's a very famous story for the in the 70s, in the 70 war, when the SAM-6 was used and the Israeli planes were using the, anyone remember, the hot balloon. So this way, the SAM, instead of going after the airplane, will explode with the balloon. That was really a modification that even the U.S. Army said, "How did you do that?" And of course, before they can give them this new modification or the secret for the new modification, what do? They ask for money. See, the weapons that we give from the United States to them goes free, but whatever modification they make on the plane, in order for us to get it back so we can use the same weapons, United States has to pay money for that. United States has to pay money for that. So this is really what the Argonne, this is their basis. This is what they do. This is what they want to do. And again, I note here the time is 1930 when they officially start making what? Camps. Training camps. Training camps on how to assassinate. Training camps on how to put mines. Training camps on attack and all of this. So this is 1930. There is still no Israel. There is still nothing really talking about that. It's all what is their own planning what they do. So 1930, British census again, and that's what they do every 10 years. They saw 1.03 million Palestinians or living there with 16.9 Jewish. Here you go. So 16.9%. So now you went up from... Yeah, from 11 to 16.9. And how did this happen? Again, by the what's called the Ilya. Ilya in Hebrew means to rise up in your spirituality. Huh? And you make the Ilya by moving from wherever you are in Europe to the Holy Land. To the Holy Land. So this is how they're making it, and this is how the number increased. British Director of Development in Palestine published a report on landless Arabs, caused by the Zionist colonization. Because when they come in again, like we said, with the money, they can buy. And once they buy, or by kicking people out of the land with the Argonne gangs, and the Arabs become refugees in their own land. Refugee in your own country. You know, how is that? So Hitler comes to power in 1933, and here you go. Whenever the war is going on there in Europe, what's happening with the Jewish nationality in the Jews, 30,000 Jewish immigrants to come to Palestine. And then in 1934, 42,000 Jewish immigrants come to Palestine. Then in 1935, 61,000 Jewish immigrants come to Palestine. Now again, what was the population? 1.03. So if you add these numbers, this is a significant number. I mean, these are significant migrations. You're coming from Europe and you're coming here to Palestine. The population in Palestine cannot absorb all this now, but it doesn't matter. But it doesn't matter. We're going to keep on sending all these people, and we're going to keep on sending them. So that the Arabs demanded the democratic institutions they have been promised by the colonial powers and the right to set limits on Jewish immigration. Say, wait a minute. You promised us United Nations Resolution 22. Look it up. United Nations Resolution number 22 is that we, after World War I, each one is going to have their own independence. Each one is going to run their own province. Up till now, here you go, it's 1933. You haven't promised us. You haven't given us this independence for us. You kept this mandate on us with the British, and you're not setting any limit to the Jewish immigration. So you got to stop these people from coming. In 1935, the British then proposed legislative council to settle disputes peacefully. And of course, I mean, we already got the Hajjana and the Irgun, right, who wants peace now. And we already, we have weapons. We bought the weapons. There's smuggling of weapons. There are other really route. Yeah, the other, you can see in the history, I'm talking about, these are all documented. From Czechoslovakia, how much they bought. I mean, you tell you exactly what kind of weapons and all these things coming from Czechoslovakia and where they were hiding them and all that. Arms smuggling now discovered in Jaffa, right? The Arabs again revolt, and the British sponsored then another inquiry. So 1936, 1939 is known as the Arab Revolt. Palestinians became frustrated from the British double standard treatment, maybe even triple and quadruple standard, you know, because again, the British, they were spineless. Just like now you see that the Americans, Kerry, after spending 1 month, 2 months, what does Alon tell him? The peace plan that he's suggesting is not worth the paper that's written on. It's not worth the paper, and nothing happens, right? He doesn't know what it is. So there's the same treatment. The same treatment that now the Americans are getting. This is how they treated the British. The Irgun gang started terrorizing the Palestinians, and that's the birth of terrorism in the Holy Land. In July 1938, Irgun terrorists set bombs in markets and other public places, killing 76 Arabs. Okay? So whoever tells you that the Palestinians are terrorists, right? Whoever tells you that the Muslims are terrorists, the first act of terrorism that is really documented, where you blow civilians, is done by the Irgun. And you're going to see who's really the president and the leader of the Irgun. He became really a prime minister in Israel. I don't know if he may have gotten a Nobel Prize. British arrest an Irgun terrorist, really, an Irgun. This is a typo. Then the Irgun gang kills 52 Arabs. And this is what's happening nowadays, if you notice. They don't like the deal with Iran, right? Whatever the United States is doing with Iran. So what do they do? Make more settlements, right? Right. The dispute, the argument is between Israel and United States on how to deal with who? With nuclear Iran. So how do they settle the difference? We're going to build more settlements. Huh? If there is an argument between China, like Israel actually sells weapons to China, modified weapons. United States doesn't like that, right? Because, you know, they know that they're not supposed to transfer this technology to China, but it doesn't care. Once we get the weapons, they are our weapons. This is the way they answer the Americans. So when there is a dispute between the weapons selling weapons between Israel and China, what do the Israelis do? Build more settlements. You should know that. Look it up. Everything, when if there are riots, if there's an intifada, what do the Israelis do? Build more settlements. Okay, what is in their mind? That erodes Israel. Erodes Israel. This is the big... Am I running out of time, right? 15 minutes. Okay, so again, this is the issue, is that always, always, they go against the Arabs. This is just really one of them. There's a lot of those wanted, and these include only nothing but the Irgun gang and the Hajjana. And this came from the British, actually, government that set their names and their faces. And I know you probably will not be able, but Menachem Begin is there, Shamir is there, Sharon is there. All of them actually are there. So if they really want to do something, right there, you can go arrest them and do something about it. Then Ben-Gurion in 1938, addressing the Jewish leaders, said, "Let us not ignore the truth among ourselves." Actually, it is a long talk. It says, why we tell these people this, we do this, ta, 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 ta. But this is the end here. It's saying, we are the aggressors and they defending themselves. This is Ben-Gurion, right? He is now the Ben-Gurion Airport, the first, Israeli president, right? Oh, no. And I have in Arabic, Sadaqaka wa huwa kathub. This is from the hadith of the Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam about Abu Huraira radiallahu anhu, when Abu Huraira busted the guy trying to steal from the masjid, from the zakah, and the first time, second time, and then the third time, he said, "I have to turn you to the Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam," and I know Sheikh Yasser said this hadith many times. The point is that if somebody says the truth as Muslims we are, as the way Muslims we are, that we take the truth regardless of that person. So if for it was a slip of a tongue or whatever it was, he was drunk and he said it, but he said the truth. They knew exactly in 1938 that they are the aggressors and the Palestinians are only defending themselves, but they sell their public relation stunt or whatever, you know, the people responsible, they sell to the other world is that they are the one who are being oppressed, and it is the Arabs and the Palestinians and the Muslims that they are not really allowing them to live in peace. So they already knew that. They already knew that. This is nothing new. So what happens if from 1990, the Zionist colonies in Palestine increase from 22 settlements to 200? From 1922, the Jewish landholding, largely through bogus and forceful methods, and again, we're not going to go through the land ownership because at the time of the Ottomans, there were no really deeds. The way in which the Western world recognized a deed of ownership, there wasn't something like this. It was mostly like the lands were inherited father to son and so on. So the Israelis or the Zionists would come and say, "Well, if you don't have a document that proves that this is your land, then this is not your land." Actually, up to now, they still do that. It's not your land unless you show us a suck, a document that tells us that this is your land. So in a way that they were taking, this is one thing. Other way, by taking a land, by kicking the Palestinians off their land, is that they buy the area where there's the water springs and the, you know, a river, beginning of a river and all that, and then they don't allow the water to run to the Palestinian land. You are a farmer. If there's no water then, you cannot use that land. So this is all ways in which actually they were able to hold on to property in Palestine. From 1918, 1930, the Jewish population in Palestine increased from 60,000 to 429,605. So they increased by 700%. And that's all through the migration from Europe. Still up to 1930, the Jewish population was only 28% of the total population. Again, these are numbers coming from the British. It's coming from the British Council. Another white paper in May 1939, as far as Grey Paper was concerned, already fulfilled that in 1939, Britain already fulfilled the Balfour Declaration, is that we help establish national indefinite Jewish immigration and land transfer to the Jews were contrary to Article 22. This is what I was saying. This is what I was saying is that, you know, they established this, they gave the Balfour Declaration, they work on Balfour Declaration, but they didn't abide by Article 22 of the United Nations, of the Covenant of the League of Nations. At that time, it wasn't really the United Nations. And the British promises to the Arabs, which Sheikh Yasser was talking about. So they only satisfied Balfour, but didn't satisfy the Article 22 of the League of Nations, and didn't really satisfy their own promise to the Arabs. Thus, within the 5 years, only 75,000 Jews would be allowed into Palestine. So this is what the British decided. Is that from now on until 1944, only 75,000 Jews will be allowed into Palestine. After 1944, Jewish migration is subject to Arab approval. From there, that's it. After 1944, no Jew can migrate from Europe except with the permission of the Arabs. And independent Palestinians will be considered then in the next 10 years. So after 1944, in 1954, right, in the next 10 years, then we will consider the establishment of the State of Israel. This is, again, the British paper, the white paper. The Zionist organization was enraged. They assassinated Lord Moyne in November 1944, and he was assassinated in Cairo. He was in Cairo. Lord Moyne, he was in charge of the mandate of Palestine at that time. They killed him in Cairo, and of course, you blame somebody else. So from there, we know that what was going on in Europe was the Holocaust. And again, we also need maybe to talk about the Holocaust at some other time. You know, what's in the Holocaust, what happened in the Holocaust, and all of these things. And for many brothers, they feel kind of passionate about the issue. Should you talk about this? We should really discuss it. This is something it should be mentioned. This is something really should be mentioned. Why? Because the Holocaust, or the so-called industry of the Holocaust, the politics of the Holocaust, as Norm Finkelstein puts it, you know, is used nothing but a power, one of the weapons of the Zionists to maintain and keep on controlling the consciousness over this on the Europeans and the Western powers to maintain their power inside Palestine. So we really have to talk about it. The U.S. refusal, you probably don't know that, to allow German Jews in 1939. I mean, if you love them so much, why you don't allow them even to come. So the issue is not that the United States refused to accept them, but the issue is that no pressure from the American Zionist organization. Lord Rothschild, right? This guy didn't say nothing. There was actually a ship, and I know I cut it out, a St. Louis ship, in which really the there was 900, about 900 or so Jews that migrated from Germany to United States. They were not allowed to come in, even that they had the papers. They were asked to go back. Why is that? Because they didn't want migration of Jews to the Western countries. They want migration of Jews, the Zionists want migration of Jews to Palestine. So even that they were running away from Germans, still they're not allowed to come into the United States. At the end, the ship settled in Northern Europe, in one of the European. A good book that will surprise you is the title, The Holocaust Victims Accused, Documents and Documentaries on Jewish War Criminals by the NK. NK is the Natori Kariat, Natur Al-Qarya. I know everybody say Natori Kariat, Natori Kariat. Their name is Natur Al-Qarya. This is a Jewish organization that are anti-Zionist. Anti-Zionist Jewish organization that really always, always speaks against Israel and the Israeli policies against the Palestinians. So there's a lot more on the hypocrisy of the U.S. and the American Zionists regarding the Holocaust, but maybe there's a lot. I mean, there's how the Zionists themselves actually terrorized some of the Jews inside Auschwitz, killing so many individuals. Only so that everybody will leave and go to Palestine. Anyone who said that they don't want to go to Palestine, they want to go to United States or to other country, then they were not allowed to. So that is also should be. So after the World War II, in 1947, Truman, backed by the Zionists, requested the immediate admission of 100,000 Jews into Palestine. This guy is the same guy who refused allowing the Jews here in the United States. He immediately, right, asks the British that you should allow 100,000 Jews into the land of Palestine. Okay? So, amazingly. The British responded by yes, but after the Zionists banned the 65,000 underground Irgun organization. They knew, the British knew that there's an Irgun militant, terrorists, and they really wanted these people. They were wanted, and they knew their numbers. You see that number? 65,000. These 65,000 of what? Well-trained. When were they established? In 1930. So where are we talking about? 1947. So that is a long time for you if you've been planning, right? If you've been practicing, if you've been preparing your own army. The Zionists blew up the King David Hotel, killing 91 Britons and some Jews. In response to this, in response to what the British said, then we went and blew up King David Hotel. And this was the first bomb that really exploded in Jerusalem. Jerusalem. You heard me? Jerusalem, the holy city, right? The holy city. But they're ready to kill whoever they need to kill, get rid of whoever is there, so that they will continue with their own plan. Jerusalem to the Jews is just like Mecca to us. Right? You cannot kill, you cannot do this, you cannot hunt, and all these, right? There are rules for them. Again, it doesn't bother them, you know, to get rid of it. The British then formed what? The United Nations. Instead of the League of Nations, now became the United Nations. Then, as President Truman is up for re-election in November 19, under great pressure from the U.S., the U.N. General Assembly recommended the partition of Palestine. Now, Truman, it was a very, again, as it's always, tight election. He needed the support. Right, he needed the money, he needed the backing of the Jewish people who are living here. So he has to champion the right of the Jews in Palestine. He had to champion the rights of the Jews. According to the United Nations census, the Arabs were 1,269,000 and the Jews were 678,000. So by far the Arabs were twice the number. Even this is by their number. By that time, the Palestinians were twice the number of it. The Jews owned less than 10% of the total land. However, the Jews were allotted with 55% of the total land. Right? So, this is right here. This is the Jewish settlements. right? This is from 1920 till 19. So all of this yellow color here, all of this, is really the Jewish settlement. Oops. And right here, right around Jerusalem. And what they were given? All of this, all of this, all of that. Now, if you are Palestinian, what would you do? Less than 10% were given more than 55% of the land. So what would you do? You're not going to accept that. Would you accept that? Any one of you would accept that? Honestly and truly. And I mean, any human being is not going to accept that. You know, how did you get this? Anyway, none of them were born in Palestine, right? They're all coming from Europe. There was a massacre, a Holocaust in Europe. If you really care about them, you know, repatriate them in the European land that, you know, if you really care about that, or send them to the United States. Why are you bringing them to Palestine? Okay? A response by saying, rejecting the partition plan, the Arab nations rejected the plans, the Muslim nations rejected the plans, the Arab nations asked for Qwairi, the newly formed International Court of Justice, here you go, but they were democratically voted down. The Arabs and the Muslims said, we need to have now a Qwairi about this, let's talk, let's discuss this issue and all that. They brought it to the United Nations Assembly, they voted on it, it was democratically brought down, so we cannot discuss this now in the United Nations. So then the Arab nation asked, how could you democratically divide a country against the will of the majority of its people? So they asked this question. Of course, third world countries don't know how democracy works exactly, and we still don't really, according to them, don't know what democracy is all about. And then what Deir Yassin is only one of them. Deir Yassin is only one of them. It is the one that the Ergun really did, and they used that as a blueprint. They used Deir Yassin as blueprint for what to do in the rest of Palestine. A blueprint of what to do in the rest of Palestine. Menachem Begin, the terrorist, led an Ergun terrorist gang and raided the village of Deir Yassin early in the morning. Right after the parents left the houses, they went to work for their farms, right, to do their farms. According to Zionist archives, 254 Arab women, children, elderly men. There was not one of age in which they can fight. There was not one of age in which they can fight in that city. And they wiped them all. They wiped them. I mean, they agree with 254, but everybody tells you the number is probably more than 500. They stuffed them in the wells. They stuffed them in the rivers. They stuffed them in every place. So when the farmers came back and they saw that, just imagine. I mean, you go to the water well where you get the water. It's all filled with bodies of your own loved ones. In their houses, they left them dead, bloody, and all of that. So this is what they did in Deir Yassin. Deir Yassin is right outside Jerusalem. Or used to be right outside Jerusalem. So they did that, and I know there are many things that they took the pictures and they started spreading the pictures all over Palestine, and they used the term as in Deir Yassin and so in other places. And I think I used it. The message of Deir Yassin, the Ergun terrorists, command sent a message to its men as in Deir Yassin, so everywhere, which means use Deir Yassin as the blueprint of how to deal with the Palestinians. Chaim Weizmann, later, the first president of Israeli regime, said it was a miraculous clearing of the land. I like that statement. Clearing of the land, right? If the riots or the killing of the Jews in Europe and in Russia, you call it pogrom, you call it Holocaust, and in Spain you call it the Inquisition, right? But the killing of the Palestinians is called what? Clearing of the land. Miraculous clearing of the land. This is his word. These are his words. Deir Yassin is now called Givat Shaul Beth. That's the name of the settlement. Part of the Greater Jerusalem envelope. That's another story. That's why we need to talk about Jerusalem. When we say Jerusalem is one thing, what they say about Jerusalem, they talk about the greater envelope from Ma'ale Adumim all the way to present Jerusalem, and also from Beit Lahem down to Ramallah. you have no idea what I'm talking about, but it's more like, instead of saying like downtown Memphis as being Memphis, they talk about from Mississippi River all the way maybe to Jackson, Tennessee. See, this is what they call, this is what, again, the terminology is important. The terminology is important. That is how Israel was established. This is a picture of some of the orphans of Deir Yassin. This is just one of the pictures to show that it was really documented and people know exactly what happened in Deir Yassin. Hundreds of villages were treated like Deir Yassin. It was the rule rather than the exception. And again, when Germans, Jews are cursed. So now we got the State of Israel established in 1948 in Tel Aviv. And it was really declared by themselves, nothing. I mean, it was they the one who declared it. It wasn't really recognized. It wasn't the United Nations. Again, that partition was nothing but a suggestion. It was a frame, a work which the United Nations thought that they can work. But the Israelis already said that we're gonna declare our own. On May 20th, the United Nations appointed Count Bernadotte with Abu Amin, right? Who's Bernadotte? Count Bernadotte, the one who established the Boy Scout, right? So the guy as a special mediator between Israel and the Arabs, he argued that the November 1947 UN partition of Palestine was provisional, which means temporary. He reminded the Israelis that if they accepted the United Nations authority, then they should go back to the United Nations to establish where and when Israel will be established. If they rejected the United Nations authority on this matter, then they should reject the United Nations resolution. I want the cake. I want this, and then I want to eat it as well, right? We're going to share it, and then I'm going to eat it as well at the same time. You cannot do that, right? So what do they do? I mean, that was an argument, a logical argument, right? If you agree with the United Nations, then let's go back to the United Nations and discuss what you're going to do and how you're going to do, right? If you disagree with the United Nations, don't say that the United Nations agreed on the Declaration of Israel, right? Either you agree or disagree. And both, he's providing a logical. So what did they do? They killed him, actually. They couldn't argue at this point, so they will end up losing their way. They couldn't label him as anti-Semite. Why they couldn't label him as anti-Semite? Because Count Bernadotte is responsible for saving 20,000 Jews from the Holocaust. And it's still fresh, right? We're still talking about 1948 and all that. So that is still, he's not Jimmy Carter. Right, Jimmy Carter, after he made the agreement, right, then he wrote his book called Palestine, Not Apartheid, right? Peace, Not Apartheid, right? So what did they label him? An anti-Semite, right? Anti-Semite. So they couldn't do that to Bernadotte. So what did they do? Killed him. Got rid of him, killed him. The next day, and who killed him? Ishaq Shamir. It's written in the Irgun document. It says that Ishaq Shamir, who became the prime minister, he was one of the prime ministers of Israel. He's the one who killed Count Bernadotte. So how about the arrest of the Arabs, the myth of the new David and Goliath? And I know I'm running out of time. And everybody says, or at least here in the West, they think that this newly formed state, right, sitting there in the Middle East, minding their own peace, right? Living in peace. And once they decided that they're going to make their own state, what happens? All the Arab countries come and they wanted to wipe them off the face of this map, right? This is at least what the United States. So what is the declassified documents from the U.S. National Archive tells you? That the CIA's 1947 assessment that the Zionist regime is taking advantage of the world's sentiments for the Holocaust and recklessly provoking the Arabs. I really took only two. There's more. There are a lot of points. My point here is that during late June and early July, the U.S. consuls reported massive amounts of arms and thousands of trained soldiers being flown from Eastern Europe. So they already have been planning for this. They already been planning, not really just by the training that they had, right, with the Irgun and the Hajjana and the weapons that they already have and the ones that they have. They're still buying and bringing in more and more soldiers after the war, right? Right now, what do they call them? Special contract, what do they call them? When special forces or those that they contract, they're in the military, retired, but bring them back, mercenaries, right? So they were bringing them. And there are more to read about this issue in the book The Birth of Israel, Myths and Reality by the Zionist historian Simcha Flapin. Again, most of what I'm saying actually comes from the book now titled The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestinians, which is also done by an Israeli historian. So all what I'm saying is really documented in books. I intentionally brought only the references from Israeli historians. I don't want to, you know, there's a lot of more that you can talk, but this is more on the facts versus Smith. On May 18, 4 days after the fighting between the Zionists and the Arabs started, the U.S. Army intelligence sent a memo to the chief of staff, stated that the combined army of the Arab forces totaled 30,000 ill-equipped. 30,000, really, farmers. Ill-equipped means they had forks. This is how they went to the war. These are farmers. And what's the weapon of the farmer? The fork. The fork that they use for their hay. That's by mostly what the Palestinians and the Arabs are. They, you know, we still remember that we were under the Ottoman rules, right? And then under the French and the British mandates. So we never, the Arabs and the Muslims of that land, they were not really free countries in which they had their own war, their own armies and all that, except for maybe Egypt and maybe part of Iraq. And they were very far from where Palestine is. And on the other hand, the Zionist army had over 90,000, not only outnumbered the Arabs 3-1, but they had modern weaponry. They bought the airplanes. They had already bought the airplanes. They already have trained pilots. And let's say these people are coming from Europe, so they are already British national, French national, German national, and whatever the, right? And they were only enlisted in the army, in the British army, in the French army, and in the German army, right? So they already well trained, and they were already flying these planes. So they already had all this practice beforehand, before coming to the war. The U.S. Army, British, and the CIA all agreed the Zionists had an army bigger, stronger, and indefinitely more advanced than all the Arabs combined. Now, this is Sharon, and this is why I put it, you know, that Ishaq Shamir saw the brilliance of Sharon, and the brilliance meaning the bloodthirstiness of Sharon. And they established for him Unit 101, and which is known, one of the first one is the massacre of Qibya, which is really in Jordan. And you see the book called Sharon and Israeli Caesar by Yuzi Benzman. He talks about how he himself cut throats of the people. This is Sharon. Now everybody is eulogizing. I know we're not supposed to talk bad about the dead. I forgot about that. Shayateen al-insi wal-jinn, right? Shayateen al-ins. Right, that's one. The Levon affair, and then in quick is that Levon affair. The Israelis actually attacked military installments in Egypt, American installments in Egypt, and they blamed. Everybody started blaming who? The Egyptians, because at that time Jamal Abdel Nasser was there. However, after investigation, the Egyptians caught the people, the perpetrators, and they knew they were nothing but Mossads. Right, the Mossad agents, and the Mossad, so these, they knew that they were really Israelis. So what happens that you start a war. Yeah? To cover all of these things, start a war and forget about this. This is came after the Levon affair, the 1956-55, the invasion of Suez Canal, and so on at that time. What we call Adwan Thulati. The 1967 then war, and again, for the sake of brevity, is that Moshe Dayan and all other leaders said, we will pay a person $1 million if they start a war with us. So they always, actually, they're the one who wanted to provoke a war, because they used the wars for what? They used the wars for what? To cover up their own dirty businesses, their clandestine things, and to acquire more land, to acquire more land. So this is their war. And the same with the 1973 Yom Kippur War. This is my daughter's. I wish you can see it. Here you go. This is what probably you cannot see, the small dots here. All these, every small dot is a village, or used to be a village. Every small dot on this map used to be a small village. And this is actually my daughter took the picture. I told her to, I wanted my 11 years old, so forgive her. You know, So you see that actually count the number of villages, and you will see how many people were massacred, killed, or kicked out of the land. You just make simple. Just there was a Holocaust. There was also what? Land clearance. There was also miraculous land clearance of Palestine. We got to do something. Each dot represents, in 20 years of land clearing operations, 2 million Palestinians were escaped. And then after that was the establishment of the PLO. And I know I'm running out of time. It's almost one. There's not going to be time information. The thing is that after the establishment of 1964, also the establishment of the Popular Front for Liberating Palestine, the PFLP, George Habash and his people. George Habash, you probably don't know the name George Habash. He's really a Christian, right? He's a Christian. He wasn't really a Muslim. He's the one who established it because they felt that the PLO was very diplomatic, very political, and so on and so on. So they wanted to be more aggressive. But what happened, he rejected everything. Everything that's Western. That's why I'm calling him Boko Haram, with all respect to the George Habash lovers. So Boko Haram is the Nigerian Muslim extremist group. Boko Haram means whatever Western is haram. That's what Boko Haram. That's the same concept of George Habash, that Western education, depending on Western countries, getting help from Western governments and all that, it's not going to make us liberate Palestine. We need to do things on our with our own and our own thing. So what he did is actually they hijacked four Western airplanes and they brought them into Jordan, and they mistreated the passengers, especially the Jews. King Hussein paying the price of having the most of the refugees in Jordan, and they have already said to the Palestinians, you already have a land, it's called Jordan. I don't know if you heard this one, but many times Sharon said it, Ehud Olmert said it, Ehud Barak said it, and they said it to King Hussein, the late King Hussein. They said it to King Abdullah, said, what is it that you are mad of? This is already, Palestine already exists, it's called Jordan. You know, just show you that they will talk to people, whoever, whatever they want to talk, the way they want to say it. But anyway, so King Hussein used this, the event of September to really get rid of all the Palestinians, the Palestinian resistance. He cannot get rid of all the Palestinians because really, most of Jordan is Palestinians. So he cannot really get rid of the Palestinians, but he got rid of the Palestinian resistance, and the Palestinians came to Lebanon. The lot of the Palestinians in Lebanon was not really any better. They also were mistreated, and there were many battles, many events. Most notable is probably Tal el-Za'atar, which I know there one brother here, he used to live in Tal el-Za'atar. If you know what happened with Tal el-Za'atar and how bad the Palestinians were massacred in Tal el-Za'atar, and Sabra and Shatila, which is much more known. Sabra and Shatila was commandeered by the late Sharon. Allah yghammilu, we say. You know, all right. So this is. I mean, he himself. There's the ways. There are maps on what did they do? How did they bring the stadium lamps, stadium lights, and they put them over Sabra and Shatila, so that they will light the whole area day and night, and day and night, day and night. They were killing and butchering the Palestinians in Sabra and Shatila. Not only the Palestinians. The cats were killed. The cows were killed. Everything, every life form was killed in Sabra and Shatila by none but really the Sharon was there overseeing this, and also the Falangists, the Lebanese Christian Falangists at that time. And then the PLO had to leave Lebanon. And just actually to show you that it's not only the Muslims and the Arabs and the Palestinians that they were ready to kill, or even the Jews themselves will kill even their own Jews, as it happens in the Holocaust, but also on the United States, there was an attack on the USS Liberty, which I met one of the sailors, one of the Navy midshipmen who was on the USS Liberty. When he was talking to me, he was crying because they cannot say it. Amazing. It's amazing, is that they cannot really come up and tell the truth for the Americans of what happened with the USS Liberty, But there is a BBC documentary on this known as Dead in the Water. I have the link here. http://whatreallyhappened.com /WRH what's really happened articles /USSLiberty.html. And I really ask, you know, just for the sake of our children, to show how bad the Israelis would do even to the American Navy or whoever it was, And again, the spying process and all this, I didn't talk about it, how much Israel spies on the United States, knowing, getting the information and so on. This is all actually in the 1976 war and the 1967 war and all that, in order for them to conduct their own wars. So in summary, alhamdulillah, the greatest real estate theft in the history of humanity. If you see the map, this is really what Palestine was. And if you still remember the orange colors here, these were the Jewish settlements. And Haifa and Yaffa are here, actually. So when you hear about the riots of Haifa and Yaffa, will be in this area here. This is at Tel Aviv. So that's where Haifa. And this is the United Nations partition plan, in which it gives really 55% to the Jews. The green portion will be the Palestinian portion. The white portion will be the Jewish portion. And I know it doesn't show here, but Jerusalem supposedly should be an international city. Jerusalem should be an international city right here. Should be internationally mandated city. And then after the wars from 1949 and 1967, this is what the Palestinians were left with. This is what they call the West Bank and Gaza. Again, West Bank, we call the occupied territories. They call the disputed territories. Terminology is very important. Why you think they call it disputed? In what context is they disputed? The whole world, they call it occupied territories. Only in Israel, they call it disputed. Why? Go back to that first map. Go back to the first map where it says the Judea. Up till now, actually, if any Palestinians come from West Bank, right, if they're getting any documents, it says from the governatorate of Judea and Samaria. I translate sometimes some of these birth certificates. It says, up till now, it says, if you're from Ramallah, if you are from Termus Aya, then the birth certificate is going to say from the governatorate of Judea and Samaria. So when they say that the Palestinians don't recognize Israel, it is what? The other way around, right? It is the Israelis who don't recognize the Palestinians. That's one thing. The second thing is, which Israel are you talking about? Put it to me on the map. Let every Israeli live within Israel. Everything will be okay. But if you don't have a map for Israel that you don't recognize, what is it that you want me to talk about? Which place? Where? Right? And right now, actually, as we speak, what Kerry is fighting over is this what we call spaghetti, right? It's really nothing but a banana republic. Look at this here. This is what they're fighting for. All that white area, the Palestinians cannot touch. And again, this is, I cannot put, if I over put here the map of the hydrology of the system, you will see that where the green area is high area, highland, where the white area is lowland. So when it rains, what's going to happen to the water? Is going to be drained and will be right there in that region, in that settlement. So the Palestinians who are farmers, who live off their land, what's going to happen? They don't have access to the water, right? They're not going to have access to the water. So what's going to happen to them? Again, it's the same plan. It started in 1920. They continue on the same plan. They're continuing on the same plan. Drive the Palestinian out of their land. So this is really what, you know, I don't have it there. So this is what Kerry is trying to say, Palestinian, independent Palestinians say, that's what they're talking about. This is what they're really talking about. This is the independent Palestinian state. Here you go. You see that? This, and right here is what? Jericho, right? Right? And this here is Al-Khalil. And there's a lot of things now going on this. So just to continue, where do we go from here? We should all know, I am not Palestinian. No? By birth, I am not a Palestinian. Right? I am Lebanese, born in Ghana, Africa, and my grandparents are Turks. Right? And I'm in America, my children are Americans, and my wife is Ethiopian. but Palestine is from us. You understand? And I think the Sheikh was talking about the importance of Palestine. Palestine is for us. Okay? It is not, if the Palestinians are no longer there, it doesn't mean nobody should claim Palestine. Masjid al-Aqsa is for us. Right? For us. Just like Mecca is for us, Masjid al-Aqsa also for us. This is what we should have. That's number one. We have to own it. Other thing is that we should know Palestinians have been betrayed by everybody. Palestinians have been betrayed by everybody. They have been betrayed by the United Nations, betrayed by the West, betrayed by the Arabs, betrayed by the Muslims, betrayed by their own Palestinian leadership as well. So they were betrayed by everybody. Wallahi, just their presence in Palestine is a jihad. Wallahi, I say it from my heart. Their presence in Palestine is a jihad. Their breath in Palestine is jihad. Whatever struggle that they go through in Palestine is a jihad. Huh? All these Western countries that they talk about democracy, you see, they don't, I mean, it's not, they use term democracy just as a token word, you know, to say, to put it on you as you understand or you don't understand democracy. That's not what they want. It's just another way of suppressing others, using the term democracy. And that's all what they do. That's all what they do. Everybody understand, you cannot live. You cannot live in this area. You cannot, there's no way. You talk about viable Palestinian state? Viable? This is really the green. If I put in now the so-called settler highways, huh? If I put there the settler highways in this green, small green left, then you're going to see what spaghetti state that I'm talking about. That the Palestinians are not allowed to. And again, this is their own land. Again, this is their own land. And I know the time is running out, but we have to become an activist. We all have, just like Chaim Weizmann was an activist, just like that chemist, right? He wouldn't give anything out except with a agreement that this is what we want to do. Then we also have to become that activist. We should talk to people about Palestine, talk about what's going on and how. And this is actually Welcome Palestine. This is coming after the United Nations last vote on the issue of recognizing Palestine. And you can see actually here, 138 countries recognized Palestine, and 41 countries didn't recognize or abstain, and 9 countries voted against it, against the recognition of Palestine in the United Nations. These 9 countries are United States, Canada, Australia. So that's 3, and another 6 countries that are present in South Pacific, banana countries, Micronesia, Sao Paulo, and all these, Pololo, and all these things, they are, all of them, their population won't be half a million, right? So all of these, nobody have heard of these countries, you know, but you can also pay them to vote for you or against you. And thank you for coming. Thank you for listening. And I really want you to know that tomorrow is Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Day. And honestly and truly, activists, being activists in this country means that you should really participate in all of these things. Then don't think that you are living here and using your citizenship as a passport. That's the worst thing you can do, is that when you carry the citizenship as a passport so you can go and come back and don't get, but you will be bothered anyway, right? But you need to be here and you need to use your citizenship and lobby your leader, just like Chaim Weizmann did. You can follow that man and follow the same procedure there. And I know for the Bob Dylans and those who like Bob Dylan, I have really one of his quote of his lyrics, and I'm not going to do it now. I know I'm running out of time. Thank you. And
Zakumullah khair. Zakumullah khair, Dr. Nabil, for a very thorough presentation.